This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. On Saturday, April 15th of 2017, I hosted the live Word Temple Poetry Series, and we had three poets read that evening, as usual, opening with Sonoma County Poet Laureate Emerita Terry Arrett, and then a very exciting new poet by the name of Erin Rodoni, followed by Gillian Wagner. I will just use the introductions that I gave at the series for you to learn about them. So you can just sit back now and enjoy an evening at the Word Temple Poetry Series. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Word Temple Poetry Series. I'm Catherine Hastings. And I'm really happy to see this number of people here tonight because I received emails from so many people saying, can't come because of Easter, can't come because of Passover, can't come because, you know, this and that. So thank you very much for coming. I know the poets will appreciate it, too. This is kind of a 16 Rivers poetry night at Word Temple because we have Terry Arrett, who is a co-founder of the press and who is a wonderful poet herself, and our two featured poets, Gillian Wagner and Erin Rodoni, are celebrating their books with 16 Rivers Press. So we'll just get started here, and we're going to open with our local poet, Terry Arrett. She is the author of four collections of poetry, most recently a very beautiful book called Night Sky Journey. Is that Kelly Cove Press? Yeah, that's what I thought. And as I said, she's the co-founder of 16 Rivers Press. She also served as Poet Laureate of Sonoma County. And as her project, she created an online calendar and events page called Sonoma County Literary Update. Is that right? Thank you. So that's been really, really valuable in this county for everyone who wants to go on and to see what literary happenings are going on all over the county. It's a beautiful project. Terry's poetry, essays, stories, and reviews have appeared in numerous magazines and anthologies. Her poems have won several literary awards, including the National Poetry Series, California Commonwealth Book Club Award, Nimrod Hardman Pablo Neruda Prize, and she has also received four Pushcart nominations. When she's not writing her own poems, Terry is very busy teaching workshops here in Sonoma County. If anyone is interested, you can talk to her afterwards. And I also know that now and then she leads these wonderful literary trips to Ireland. So, but right now you get to hear her read her poetry. So please welcome Terry Arrett.
Thank you, Catherine. This is a great pleasure for me because I have not had the opportunity to hear Gillian and Erin read together from their new work, their just published books. I had the great pleasure of publishing a book along with Gillian in 2008, so we did a number of readings together then, but I get to hear her new work tonight along with Erin's. And yes, I do teach in a variety of capacities across Sonoma County, and for many years I taught with the California Poets in the Schools program. And this is a poem that comes out of that experience. It was written back in March of 2009, which seemed a dark time then, far more innocent to me looking back at it now. It's called School Visit, March 8th, 2009. No offense, Marco says, but I don't really get your poems. That's okay, I tell him. I don't always get them either. Marco's in the fifth grade, Mrs. Ehrig's class, and they needed a guest writer to show up on Dr. Seuss's birthday. So I showed up. It was the morning I got my contact lenses, left eye, close up, right eye, distance. The morning all the straight edges of things disappeared and doors became trapezoids, even the lines on the page curved like global latitudes. The ophthalmologist's instructions hadn't included navigation. Marco brightens when I ask if anyone's ever gotten into trouble. His hand shoots up. He wants to know why everyone got into trouble. Dr. Seuss, me, Odysseus. What did they do? He asks. What did you get in trouble for? So I tell them about playing tricks in war, which the gods will punish you for, even when you win, even when the trick's their idea. I tell them about apartheid and South African divestment and climbing out the window of the old Union when the cops arrived, about editors who wanted a turtle to look less like a German helmet, who were nervous about ideas slipping through the rhymes. The teacher steps in to ask, "Boys and girls, we learned a word last month about this kind of trouble. Remember Little Rock? Remember Selma?" A girl in the front row's hand goes up, and before she can pronounce the word, it's already bouncing from desk to desk. "Dissent," I hear them say. And I think dissent is a good word to know if you're in the fifth grade, a word not frequently taught, most certainly not since the towers fell, since the doors and windows all slammed shut. I suppose it's worth knowing when you're, say, 11 years old, and you feel like the butt of everyone's joke, that sometimes the world can be made wrong, that sometimes the fault isn't yours, that maybe your kind of trouble is just what the world needs to make it right. Lately, I've been leading a workshop where we read and discuss and take from inspiration from Dante's Divine Comedy. We spent a year in Inferno. We've spent the past year climbing Mount Purgatory, and we're just about to enter Paradise. Between Purgatory and Paradise, I'll be leading a group of writers on a, I guess you could call it a field trip to Florence this June. So I'm going to read a couple of pieces that come out of the Dante readings. And the first one has a note that goes with it, so I'll start with that. In Inferno, cantos 26 through 27, Dante and Virgil meet the souls of those who in their life gave fraudulent counsel. They appear as flames, thousands and thousands, filling the circle below them like fireflies in June. Among these flames is the honey-tongued Odysseus, also known as Ulysses, who convinces his comrades at the end of their lives to set sail to the west to find what lies beyond the known world. Odysseus's ship comes near the island of Mount Purgatory, glimmering on the horizon, but a whirlwind comes up and sweeps the ship and all on board to the bottom of the sea. This is called All Hands Lost. De remi facemo ali al folle volo. We made wings of our oars in a wild flight. It's a ghost ship, the lost boy said before he was lost. A ship in a bottle with no hands on deck. Inside the glass, what remains of that thirst for salt, the longing to see a silver island rising out of the watery world, its rivers flowing into the sky, with breaching whales and great schools of fish glittering in the moonlight. Like a firefly, the ghost ship blinks in the darkness, tricking us into thinking we have it, cupped in our hands. We open them empty. Take out a pen and write the word firefly, but already the spark has flown somewhere else, and the ghost ship in the bottle lists a little starboard, its broad sails bellying with the wind that isn't there. This next one comes from Purgatorio, Canto 11, and the quote is, "Those shades moved on beneath their weights, like those we sometimes bear in dreams." Forgiven. A liquid night, the air and sky falling, filling the garden, its spiral beds, the quiet graves of zucchini, beans, potatoes. Cherry leaves cup the rain, and dawn climbs slowly out of darkness, saturated, satiated. Out on the road, the wet pavement sings with rain. The wipers beat out their syncopated rhythms. The world comes awake in the half-light. Somewhere in Oakland, a car loses traction, flips on its side, its human cargo jolted into sudden prayer, sudden curse, sudden blessing. We don't deserve this, I think, inches over seasonal average, but the rain, we know, falls on the just and the unjust, falls on us all, our unforgiven selves. We weigh our souls against feathers, feel our backs hunched, burdened by stones we've forgotten we put there, gathered years ago from the fields we had hoped to make fertile. And the last one, this was written a while ago, but it tells of a place I will be visiting again in June, and where I lived for a while when I was a student in Florence. Most people know the great domed cathedral in the center of old Florence as Il Duomo, the home of God. But its name is really Our Lady of the Flowers. Via del Salviatino. The place I love is a road that winds up the shaggy hill from Florence to Fiesole. I walk this road in the drowsy hours of late afternoon, the day's accumulated heat now radiant in the low stone walls that line both sides of the roadway. I stop to take a swig of warm water from the liter bottle I've carried and refilled all day since this morning's cool of the Brancacci Chapel, its twin frescoes of the weeping exiles. Swaddled innocents in their porcelain blue tondos, this afternoon's diesel fumes and cup of gelato from the bar Tabacchi in Piazza San Marco, the damp and sweating bodies of the visitors crowding the tiny chapel in the Medici Palace, where young Giuliano and Lorenzo, in gold leaf, process along the walls eternally toward Bethlehem. And the 300-year-old wisteria still climbs the trellis high above the courtyard, spreading its fragrant blossoms against the pale summer sky. I stop, lean over the sun-warmed stones, the air dusty with cypresses and ripening olives, the early evening bells of Our Lady of the Flowers drifting up the breast of the valley from her great dome. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was lovely. Well, I love it when someone comes here with their very first collection of poetry. It just is a very special event. And first books are just really exciting. And tonight, Erin Rodoni is here celebrating her first full-length collection, Body in Good Light. Her poems have appeared in places such as the Adroit Journal, Cider Press Review, Nimrod International Journal, and Best New Poets 2014 Anthology, among others. Her wonderful poem, one of the poems I really enjoyed, hint, hint, Leaving Labor and Delivery, was awarded a 2013 AWP Intro Journals Award. Ilya Kaminsky, who read for Word Temple about 12 years ago now, calls Body in Good Light a marvelous debut. Quote, I walk toward you barefoot, writes Erin Rodoni, a poet who can speak with ease of private elegies and public journeys, of childbirth and of changing trains in Krakow, of grief on losing a loved one to cancer, and of borrowed countries where bougainvillea scales balconies like a romance language. Here is a book that journeys out into the world and also inward into the mysteries of private life of the body, where bliss, like a memory, can be unearthed by scent. Please welcome Erin Rodoni.
Hello. Thank you all for coming on this busy, busy weekend. It's wonderful to be here and to read with Terry and Gillian. So I'm going to begin with a poem called In Transit, which, there we go. my husband and I, when we were newly married, we spent some time doing what's called woofing, which is willing workers on organic farms. And we, by accident, ended up at this permaculture farm in the mountains outside Mexico City, and that inspired this poem. In Transit. Faith roosts inside a hatchback. It breaks down near a farm just after sunset. We undress in the dark, raw milk nuzzles into our dreams. We wake laden with tasks, a dirt road to gravel, saplings to splint. A cistern spools the summer rain, and slugs grow fat as cherubs. The white dog, Paloma, with her long teats and sphinx eyes, rolls away from her pups, slamming the door of her sleep. Tio drills us on herbs. Se llama salvia, we bark, se llama menta. Until our cheeks grow hot with our naming, teeth purr in the curve of our jaws, there's a tree at the center of the garden. Tio touches its trunk, whispers, Se llama llorando sangre, crying blood. It sirens the scent of sage and mint, its roots wrestle with the worms. Tio says to cut it back. Clumsy machetes split bark like shin, its name bleeds out into the copper morning, slick, limbless, blooming now with butterflies and bees. So this next poem is called Perpetual Labradors. And it's about us. When I was growing up, we had a series of Labradors that always seemed to run into each other. That's where the name comes from. Fire, Taisy, Maggie. I never saw them die. Taisy, Maggie. A sleek black line, eyes electric green in a thicket of dark. The vet made a house call. His hands smelled like his office, iodine and piss. Their lives are shorter than our need. That is the tragedy. When my brother married a girl named Maggie, there was only one punchline. Your wife or the dog? Maggie has fleas. Maggie got into the neighbor's garbage again. Maggie's sick. It was his wife. The ancient lab tottered to another spring. For a year, we called her name, and something alive came, panting. I'm trying to tell you... I've seen others vanish from my brother's bed, as if death is only another abandonment. We've all been severed from a beloved body. We've all learned to shake off our sparks and arrow toward tasks we are trained for. Even you, with the whole world flashing breasts like Mardi Gras, must choose one path into the muck. My father trained them to retrieve ducks. It was their destiny to crash through marsh grass each December, to cradle the fallen bird with a tender mouth, lay it gently at his feet. They weren't ours to spoil. They lived in the yard and ran in their sleep. When arthritis finally locked their hips, they entered the house uncertain as fawns, paws sliding on hard wood, but soon found their place at the foot of someone's bed. Each time I watched my brother help my father lift a sheet-wrapped body, carry it to the bed of his pickup, each time the earth gave a little, less beneath my weight. This poem is called Driving All Night with God. Windows open to the dark, some species of sweet wine tucked between our seats. You taught me how to pray, parked on back road beaches. Green numbers on the dash flashed the sound of crickets. Seashells portioned, the canned applause for creation. You loved it when I praised a doe's neck, scythed like the milk blade moon. When I gleaned from wind-stunted scrub the molting antlers of a buck, a hint of half-clean bone. Once a burst of souls inflated your lungs like a respirator. Your chest strained the seatbelt. Our pickup rearing toward that wonder, veering across the yellow line, God. You seem smaller now, behind your rifle sight. You brag me through a wallet thick with children. I'm a little afraid of you. Do you still like to catch the deer before your headlights do? Catch them moving through the dark, the way a girl moves through a bar when she still believes she is immune? Choose your weapon. I know your roots. When you come back, I'll be waiting in your high beams, antlers leveled. So I'm going to skip ahead to the last section of my book, which has a lot of poems about childbirth, as Catherine alluded to. The first is called Manifest, and it has an epigraph. It's by Jean Valentine, the epigraph, and it's, it stared right through them to the world. We're one bead on the nation's wet skin. Traffic clears its throat in the mute evening. On the radio, another market pops like a beer can with a hiss. History's such a narrow room. Rain interrogates the windshield. The man who's about to find out he's a father seams the minnowing crowd like a reporter with a headline. What are you now? Already, bright capitals of your vitals landmark my sleep, and promises keep arriving like pilgrims. They constellate flickering settlements across an expanding future, where the man who's becoming a father swings you onto his shoulders. Some teenage pop princess, her face powdered by moth wings, takes the center of a chalk diamond. Her anthem glares through the bomb shelters of our skulls, sparking myths, wicks of Roman candles. And this is Leaving Labor and Delivery. And it's exactly what it sounds like. Nurses pop in and out like cuckoo clocks. They unwrap us and refold us, you in your swaddling and me in my bandages, Yes, I am your mummy, and this is morning. This is night, both constant worrying white. We're not ready for the dark, you and I. We're not ready for the cold. We're hothouse bulbs in our bright incubator. In sleep, you expand, my little loaf, and I keep bleeding between the feedings when the nurses flock like starched cabbage moths. They prop my bubble-wrapped torso up with pillows, peel back sleep-stamped towel, and roll you out. My milk is full of bees and danger. You twitch, little addict, rooting toward this contraband. We're not ready for undigested air, for the vital flare of gasoline or jasmine, for sky greased by all-night diners or plumes of cigarette butts exhumed from roadside gutters. I watch a patch of space go black, then blue. I watch the tarred roof bruise beneath the weight of pigeons. I'm on a restricted diet. You strain the straitjacket of your swaddle. Days flip by like pages in waiting room magazines. The nurse is merciless. She shoves our wheelchair toward the door. Sun slaps shut my eyes, leaving only the imprint your new body makes. It recreates the world. And this next one is called First Night, and it's kind of a continuation of leaving labor and delivery. It's that first fraught night with a newborn when you're home from the hospital. Come to bed, you sigh as you surrender. I'm still fighting sleep like a private on first watch. The rustle of our daughter's breathing draws my skittish sight past your body sprawled like Mecca across salt flat sheets. My dark continent, wait for me on the other side. We'll reincarnate in fan-cooled rooms in borrowed countries where bougainvillea scales balconies like a romance language. We'll glove our hands in suede smooth novels drift through the off-hours emptiness of other people's lives. I dream geckos grafted to adobe walls, a cantina crowded with flirt-lashed boys, where American doo-wop summers from a jukebox and expat couples churn with the slow insomnia of landlocked seas. I sway with our girl till dawn, pass her into your arms, full of the future, like a letter carried through war. And I think I have one more, and it's called "And When You Ask, I Will Say There Were Birds." For a while, I imagined that we'd be raising our children in London, which is where my husband is from, and I was thinking about my childhood in Point Reyes and how pervasive all the different species of birds there are there, and how different it would be in London where it's all pigeons. But we actually are in Point Reyes with our children now, so I guess this is a little obsolete. But and when you ask, I will say there were birds. Swallows coalesced ink blot tests into the seep of night, and red-winged blackbirds purled each telephone line. Day traders drifted from scavenged tenements, rousing the barn owl's mantric hunger. And child, when you wonder, I will promise, dreams of flight only panic my pulse toward waking. In the hour before egrets scudded mud flats or pelicans trawled the bay, vultures posed on fence posts like treetop angels, bathing skyscraped plumes in tule fog, while newspapers still lay like dogs in driveways. The plum of my summers you will not taste, mornings sparked from branches, afternoon a hammock of hay bales and the stucco of raised nests. Child, in this aviary of fire escapes, when your hand slips my grip, I will promise, cities don't exist until we are lost in them. Thank you all so much.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's return now to the Word Temple Poetry Series.
First book. I mean, really wonderful. Really wonderful work. Thank you so much. Congratulations to 16 Rivers for finding her, and to you, Erin, for this first book. I look forward to your next one already. If you ever question the importance of small presses, here's an answer for you. Okay. And we're going to move on to another 16 Rivers poet. Gillian has read here maybe twice before at War Temple, just once before. So it's really nice to have you back again. She is returning to celebrate her latest collection in This Sweet Haphazard, a great title. This is the second collection she's published with 16 Rivers Press. Her first one was called The Opposite of Clairvoyance and came out in 2008. She has won awards that include the Dorothy Sargent Rosenberg Poetry Prize. She won that not once, but twice. And the Zocalo Public Square Prize for Poetry of Place. She is Poet Laureate Emerita of the city of Modesto. She's a junior high teacher, and she's really a mover and shaker of a great poetry reading series in Modesto at the Barking Dog Grill called the Second Tuesday Reading Series. In her latest book, Gillian reflects inspiration from places near and far, from Hurricane Katrina to forest fires, from the really big one, which we all know what that means, to a place called the Old Mill Cafe, and of course, deep imagery from the Central Valley of California. Jane Mead says, in this sweet haphazard, Gillian Wagner turns her well-tuned ear, her sharp eye, and her considerable intelligence and humor to the California of lightning fires, bulldozed almond trees, and murky rivers with unpredictable currents, as well as that of clear desert night skies, foggy coastlines, and the green light that filters through the sequoias. She sees the beauty and melancholy all around her, and she approaches it with tenderness and without aesthetic pretension. This is a beautiful book of powerful poems, and I couldn't agree more. Please welcome Gillian Wagner.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you guys for all coming out tonight. It's wonderful to have you here. If this is a small crowd, your regular crowds must be enormous. So this is wonderful. Thank you. So I am from I live in Modesto in the Central Valley now. I've lived there for 26 years or so. And I've lived a lot of other places too. I'm from Queens, New York, and I lived in Eureka. And I lived in Eureka for a long time, and San Diego, and Eureka again, and I'd never expected the Central Valley to become home. I thought, went there for a teaching job. I thought, I'll be here for a couple years, and then I'm out of here for someplace way cooler. That's not what happened. And so this poem is called Chorus. Listen, there are those of us from somewhere else, the names of birthplaces, of hometowns under our skin, tattoos always felt, never seen. We live here now, though we always meant to leave. And there are those of us who were born here, passing the landmarks of our lives so often we don't think about them. We never meant to stay. This place was marked as just for now, as stepping stone, as temporary on our well-drawn maps. But for one reason or another, years pass, and we find ourselves hot-stepping with jobs and kids and this and that and a million little possessions. Now, the kids say they want to move away. They point their faces the same directions our faces used to point. We'll let them go, of course, knowing more of them than they think will come back, and that various wayfarers, too, will stop for lunch and find themselves staying for years' worth of dinners. They will all find themselves here with the earth spreading out around them, whispering a welcome. They will be more than a little surprised to hear. So there is a cafe in our town called the Old Mill Cafe, and it was really old school. It actually had a big windmill out front. It was blue and white, and I don't know how long it had been there, maybe forever. And they built an overpass, and they had to knock down the Old Mill Cafe and move it down the road, so the windmill was gone, and it looks really, really ordinary now. But the old Mill Cafe needed a poem. The Old Mill Cafe. Everyone knew where to sit. Everyone knew what time the men from the dairy plant came in after the night shift. Everyone knew when the all-night drunks would come looking for breakfast. Everyone knew when Sandy's girl ran away and why. Everyone knew the size of the pancakes. Everyone knew the windmill might really work, but then again, who could be sure? Everyone knew when the junior college let out for summer. Everyone knew when the talk was that the highway would be decommissioned. Everyone knew when the hometown boy made good. Everyone knew when the waitress was homesick and that she wasn't sick at all. Everyone knew and everyone commented when something wasn't right. Some folks commented with words and more words, and some just nodded, and some didn't even nod. Everyone knew that team didn't deserve to win that championship game. Everyone knew the goddamn hippies weren't welcome. Everyone knew the smell of fresh coffee and the little clanks of the creamer lids. Everyone left that stool empty for a long time after Charlie passed. Everyone clutched their coffee cups when the train passed through, could have touched the train as it squeezed by, the truth then, but not now. Everyone heard about the accident, and then everyone knew or thought they knew. Everyone knew wind from the west meant a little rain. No one knew what happened to that kid who used to bust tables. Everyone knew when the price of almonds just about dropped through the floor. Everyone knew the overpass was coming and that the old mill would be raised. Everyone knew the cafe would reopen way down the street, and no one was happy about it. Everyone knew they would keep going to the new place, which they did, even though it wasn't the same. Eggs tasted different. Everyone knew that things don't stay the same, and there's no use in whining about any of it. So, Modesto has a large homeless problem, as do many cities, and it's one that we're working on, but it's a slow, something that is slow to take hold. So we have several churches that serve dinners, and I was driving home one day, and this was a scene outside one of those churches. It's called Distraction, Furious, and Brief. The Baptist church serves dinner at 4, and the line starts early, snakes around the shady side of the building. Afternoon moves as slowly as summer heat lifts, which is to say, it almost doesn't. Bits of lives sink into the sidewalks. Someone fixes a wheel on his cart of possessions. Someone swigs something and passes it to his right. And a woman in a sundress, colors of spring, crosses the street, head up, chin out, confident the whole world's watching, and some of them are as she stops mid-crosswalk, hoisting her skirt high, shaking her nakedness up and down, swinging her hips, her flesh a mass of pink and bruise, head back, baring her teeth at the sky. She turns and hip bumps a furious circle dance, even as the light turns green, even as there are catcalls and honking, even as some in the supper line look away and some in the line shrug and some keep watching as she runs the rest of the way across the street, skirt up, 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 and the traffic moves on, and it's 10 till, still hot, and the long days just the same as always. There are sometimes you're really glad your child is not in the car. So, we live in an older neighborhood in Modesto, and with maybe any neighborhood, old or new, there's always that house in the neighborhood that you kind of wish could just somehow disappear from your neighborhood. And this is called House for Sale. The house is loosened. It's unbounded, unbound by its walls and fences. It's coming unfenced. Joints gone, all loosey-goosey. Boards missing, couches jumping ship or shipped out. Appliances falling outdoors. They tumble and slide. They crash and dent. They crash their object bodies onto the grass and the curb, into the gutter. The house is junked. The junk that was housed is unhoused, half-orphaned, box spring skeleton rusts in droughted grass, mass of whatnot, chair in a tree. There is a yellow chair in the gangly fig tree. Hapless, hopeless, helpless, this junked junk house, this heap of forlorn with its cataract windows, with its bike parts and washing machine, with man A asleep, pillow, blanket out like a light on a flatbed trailer untrailed in the driveway, with man B awake, unshirted and surly, harvesting washer parts, calling back into the house with its blinkless windows, with its doors loosely hinged and hanging doors unslung. It's an open museum. The ordinary made freakish. The toppled fridge props up the trailer. Dining table next to motorcycle, next to deflated football. Jukebox, tire pile, paint can, pyramid, plastic box of Santa parts. Next to the for sale sign, this fixer-upper, this great deal, this potential dream home for just the right buyer, for just the right stout of heart, do-gooder, patron saint of hard work and hopeful causes, chair in tree included. I don't think I'll be going into real estate soon. But. So that's a tiny bit about where I live, but one place where I have spent a lot of time is Humboldt County, where I lived as an elementary school student for a few years and then went back to for college. I needed to leave San Diego as quickly as possible and get back to places with trees, real trees that didn't feel strange. So I went back to Humboldt State for college, and Humboldt and the whole coast region, as much as I love Modesto, kind of remains the home of my heart. So I have a series of poems called Avenue of the Giants Auto Tour, and it goes from north to south. So it's stop number 8 to stop number 1. Stop number 8, the Drury Cheney Loop. I would like to have Alice's little bottle now. Drink me. And I would shrink down so that the redwood sorrel would be a forest around me, and I could look up through it, the light green and underwatery, the sound of sorrel leaves trembling in the not-quite wind, in the breath of the forest, the sound of the bell as it leaves the bell. And I'd wander, hidden in my frail forest, until I came to a fallen log where the wood's gone spongy, and I'd lie there for a little while. A fallen redwood can take 500 years to decompose, and while doing so, while the black beetles and the wood ants do their luxurious, necessary work, the old tree feeds the new. I'd lie there undisturbed, listening to the movements of their insect jaws, and when ready, I'd nibble a tiny bit of sorrel stem, taste the tangy white juice, and rise again, my original size, the path close at hand, other tourists round the next bend, immense shadows shifting, shaking bits of forest out of the tangle of self. Stop number 7, Chandler Grove. My father-in-law is dead, but here he comes from his walk on the trail. It's a short walk, and he's winded but shining. The redwoods, he says, looking up. The redwoods. The sun pours through them, mineral-like and grand. My father-in-law leans against a tree, raises his small black camera. There's a click, and he's gone. And we are left with what's here. The redwoods winding up and up, the canopy, a great cantilevered cathedral ceiling, and from somewhere up there, wing flutter and chattering, a thrush we never see. Keep trying to keep track of time on my phone, and it always blacks out on me.
Don't worry.
Stop number 6, Dyerville Overlook. The afternoon light sends out long shadows, shadows of trees, of family, shadow of bluff falling down on the river, which bends out of shadow, silver as a trout. The Forest Service sign tells a thing or two, how the bluff is 30 feet of fill, remnants of the washed away town, door sills and enameled sinks, rail ties and tires and window glass, the crushed porches of Main Street. Not the purpose they were meant to serve, but still serving a purpose. Beneath our shadows, the bluff creaks and groans, like the stairs the mayor of Dyerville climbed on his lonesome way to bed. The Dyerville Giant. When a tree falls in a forest, a tree like that anyway, with all those years ringing in it, having sprouted out of the soft earth before Jesus was even a spark in his father's bright eye, when a tree like that falls, it cracks and echoes so that even the gnats careening in the sun near the creek take pause. And when this tree fell, the crash was like trains colliding. The ground inhaled and held its breath, waiting for impact. The sound rolled through the forest and made salamanders hide in their damp burrows. It thundered like a train wreck, and so the townsfolk drove out to the trestle to see the havoc, while the fine silt of redwoods rose and then settled in the forest behind them. And most of that's taken from a report of a man who was there when the Dyerville Giant, this enormous tree, fell. And everybody did apparently drive out to see what had happened at the train trestle, and it wasn't there at all. Wow. Stop number 5, Mahan Plaque. And so the lesson is this. Prison is still prison, even if the prison happens to be among redwoods and owls, up a gravel road lined with the soft arms of ferns, with a view of the mountains, and before them the ravine, through which you've been told a river runs, flat and silver toward the sea. But the river doesn't matter, and the mountains and the owls don't matter. A prison is still a prison. And so here's your wanted poster, taped to a redwood log, your eyes bleak and young, looking out at the scenery. Some of the tourists read the Mahan plaque, and some read your poster, under trees that render all of us impossibly small, that make our voices into murmurs, drifting out and away in the breeze, which high in the treetops sounds like the highway, and the highway, you know, leads toward home. Stop number 4. Wiat. The town is gone, washed out in the Christmas flood of 64, when the river in which they fished, in which they swam, in which they paddled tin canoes, the South Fork of the Eel, next to which they built bonfires, next to which they kissed while the moon kissed the river, down which they sent logs to the mill, over which they built the bridge, next to which they built the town, described as bustling that December, when it rained for days and the river rose 33 feet above the highway and took what it wanted, and it wanted nearly everything, and left just the sidewalks, which you can still find if you look hard enough and are schooled in the ways of persistence and brambles. Drive-through tree, Myersville. Forgive me, America, I do not want to drive through a tree. I would not mind being somehow inside a tree, a part of the tree, to feel the soft hum of treeness, the click as one ring solidifies and another begins its history. But to drive my car through a tree violates some unspoken rule of etiquette, seems as terribly awkward as showing up uninvited to a wedding of a couple, one of whom you used to date. I don't know if the tree minds, America. I don't know if it cares about being a roadside attraction, but I can't help but think it would rather be left alone with its birds and its sunlight, nursing its bright new growth. I can't help but think the tree more content if the cars were over there on the highway, moving quickly somewhere else. Stop number 2, Bowling Grove. Each ecosystem makes its own set of rules, coordinates for this, logarithms for that. In this canopy, at the axis of X being the limb and Y being the trunk, the years accumulate their treasures of fallen needles and twigs, The mat builds and builds. The air grows more humid above it with its spongy corridors, with its microbial cities. Salamanders move in with their small possessions to feast. The hawks land and survey the silvery distance. A dogwood tree grows ownerless and lovely 200 feet up, its roots clenched tight in the limb of the redwood. The arboreal salamanders live out their lives up there, their small black feet never once touching the ground. In the afternoon breeze that carries in the fog, the dogwood claps out a soft applause, exponents for continuing this existence. Stop number one, Franklin K. Lane Grove. The road is 40 miles, then it ends here and sloughs us back onto the freeway, going southward, south, southward. But starflower, trillium, the heart sings, remembering their shy ways, and the blood hums the green and liquid songs of ferns, and the skin relishes the cool of the fog, and the soul breathes slowly in and out and in, savoring its finite cache of redwood-flavored air. And the mind, in its pragmatism, steels itself against homesickness, placing word next to word, beginning to consider the poem. That's true. We left there, and I was already considering how I was going to write about this. I just knew that was going to happen. Sometimes writing comes up because of things you see. Sometimes it comes up because of things you hear. And I'm a pretty good eavesdropper and pretty good on picking up on odd conversations and odd bits of news. News especially kind of strikes me as it strikes me. Luckily, we're being provided with plenty of new strangeness these days. So... But I'll read a couple of more poems. And this is called New Life with Bees and Fire. It's from a headline in 2015, my dad had dementia, and we spent a lot of time watching news and sitcoms. Barney Miller was our favorite. And one day we were watching the news, and there was a story. Woman gives birth, fights off bees, starts wildfire in Northern California. And you're like, that's quite the to-do list. So... this is called New Life with Bees and Fire, and it is from the point of view of the infant. My mother's head was wreathed in nonsense. My mother's head was wreathed in the shadows of owls, and sometimes in stars, a million winks around her. My mother's head was wreathed in sweat, in tears. My mother's head was wreathed in bees. Their buzzing was the second language I learned. My mother's head hung low when she slept. My mother's head was wreathed in regret. She whispered in the night, no phone, no water, four apples to eat, stupid shortcut through the woods, over the river and through the woods to grandmother's house. She sang and she whispered. Her head hung low when she slept. Her breathing was the first language I'd learned. My mother's head was wreathed in apple breath. My mother's head was wreathed in daylight, then moonlight. My mother's head was beautiful and terrible in sorrow. My mother's head was close to mine, close to mine. Her breath was warm and soft and apple-riddled. My mother's head was wreathed in daylight again and again. My mother's head was filled with getaway plans. Walk out, float out, fly out on the wings of owls. My mother's head was wreathed in nonsense, in tears. My mother's head was wreathed in smoke. My mother's head was wreathed in smoke and in flames that rushed and crackled. Fire was the third language I learned. My mother's head close to mine, her lips close to mine, breathing and breathing with the smoke all around her. My mother's head was wrapped in relief like stars when the rescuers came. They tamped out the fire. They took us away from the owls and shadows, the bees, the flames, the winking stars. And we began to begin the beginning again. And so mother and baby were both fine, and the baby will be two this summer. As I said, my dad had dementia. He'd been sick a long time. He had dementia among several other issues. And he we spent a lot of time together over, especially the course of that last year, but over that whole time. This is called My Father Begins to Disappear. I'll read this and then one more poem. My father has no fat on his bones. Blue veins run the lengths of his stringy muscles, down his wrists and across his hands. A foundering delta, a delta silting itself in and disappearing. His hands are bone and skin, even the palms gone slack. His nails are brittle and crack for no reason. Every day there is less of him. He used to say that when the time came, we should set him adrift at sunset to find his own Valhalla. We would laugh, say yes, of course, but now, each day bringing that time closer, my father says less and less. Even the words he wants to say get caught on his tongue and lost. He shakes his head, never mind. His hips hurt. Bruises don't heal. The house is never warm enough. Home from a visit, I realize that I barely spoke with him. He's the shade in the corner, almost a photograph of himself, almost a discreet set of memories. He's becoming past tense. Dad on a swing in Cape Cod, blowing soap bubbles for me. Dad running us around the house on his shoulders. Dad dancing, pretend debonair in the kitchen. Dad at his favorite marina, smiling. Not one of the docked boats behind him prepared to take him aboard. So as I said earlier, Modesto did become my home in spite of myself. We have good friends there. We like our jobs there. Our daughter was born there. My dad died there. And so Modesto is, for better or for worse, just part of who I am now. This poem and the book, This Sweet Haphazard, is a direct reference to my Modesto. This Sweet Haphazard. No one calls this town pretty. Not with the dusty oleanders off the freeway and the ragged fence boards and backyards propped up with 2x4s and the canals with their twin lies of slow and safe and the ash trees, dead branches dangling in the large pale no one's home houses and the foreclosed houses and the small houses with their carefully tended geranium borders with the plum trees gone overripe and sticky. No one calls this town pretty, with the heat rippling off the parking lots and the sighs of aunts and uncles sitting in the shade of garages filled with cars that were once made to go places, and the church marquee scolding that Jesus did not read porn, and the swarms of mosquitoes buzzing the standing water from the leaking sprinkler heads in the park. And yeah, no one calls this town pretty, as the creek laps at its share of shopping carts and the untended grasses bleach dry by April and the public pools are mostly closed, but the sky here turns indigo on summer nights and the hummingbird chases the sparrow from the feeder and the kids on the soccer field run as fast as kids anywhere, oblivious to the town around them because, after all, it isn't so bad. It's an okay town. We know where all the roads go, and we know where to get good coffee, and we know what time the train pulls through. We know, too, we're more than soil, more than sky, more than what you've read in the news. And no, it isn't pretty, but we still live here. And tonight, the moon will rise almost full over the sweet haphazard of home. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Catherine.
This is Catherine Hastings. You've been listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. You heard Terry Arrett, Aaron Rodoni, and finally Gillian Wagner. If you have any comments or questions about today's program, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.